Hello, everyone. This is Kate Alves, and I have Joe Barry, Pat Barry, and Sean Corker with me. Today, we thought we would touch on a few topics, and in particular, the one area that has been ramping up volatility in the markets, and that's the escalating trade tensions between the U.S. and China. So let's kick it off with tariffs, since it is the dominating headline. Joe, can you put the trade war in perspective?
Ever since I think one country did business with another country, it didn't take long for them to come up with tariffs to protect their local workers. Tariffs have been around forever. There's thousands of them. They've been around before the current administration. It's really part of business life. I mean, give you an example. In America, before the income tax, which was 1913, we funded our whole country with tariffs. It was 20% on everything that came into America. But with the globalization and the World Trade Organization in recent years, the tariff issue hasn't really been on the front page. But every other product coming into the United States has had a tariff on it, generally only about 2%, unless you had a good lobbyist. And I'm going to tell you one little story that kind of is an example of how crazy these tariffs can be. Back in the 60s, the French chicken ranchers wanted to protect their business from American imports. So they convinced the French government to put a 25% tariff on chicken that was being imported into France. Well, naturally, we in America weren't going to tolerate not retaliating, so we put a 25% tax on French wine and other products. Well, the folks in Detroit saw an opportunity here. They went and lobbied Lyndon Johnson and said, hey, listen, we could be making a lot more money and hire a lot more people if there was a tariff on foreign-made pickup trucks. And Johnson agreed to put a 25% tax on any BMW or Mercedes or any European-built small truck. So that's a reason why you don't see pickups from those brands in America. They have to pay, or we have to pay, a 25% chicken tax on foreign-made pickup trucks. What's the point in giving you all of this? This is part of life. It's not the real risk. The trading and tension that comes from day-to-day tweets and announcements on again, off again with the China talks, I think could cause some disturbances in the market, but it's really not where we think the risks are. Sean, what would you like to add?
I'll just add, let's put it into perspective, because $500 billion, and that's what's being talked about right now, just sounds like a staggering amount, but it's only about 2% of our total GDP. So it's impactful, but not that impactful. And there's been a lot of fits and starts. We don't know what's going to be the end result, because there were talks about putting taxes on autos being imported from Europe, and that's on, that's off again. So until it's done, we really don't know what the financial implications are. We do have one example, though, because last year there was a tariff placed on washing machines, and it was a 20% tariff, and the expectation was this would be good for the U.S. manufacturers of washing machines. But what actually happened was they raised their prices, and the consumer felt the pain. The cost of washing machines went up 12% last year, and although dryers were not impacted by the tariff, manufacturers decided to raise their prices on dryers too. So the concern is that the consumer is going to see some higher prices if these tariffs do come through.
Good point.
Good. Let's shift to China. So China's economy is second in size to the U.S., is in fact slowing. We've also seen the growth of China's economy changing. And a question that I often hear is, you know, what does this China slowdown mean for world growth? And more importantly, what does it mean to investors who may look to China as a place to invest? Pat, would you like to comment on that?
Sure. Well, China's come a long way from 19 years ago when they really got underway and industrialized and became one of the biggest, the biggest emerging market in the world. I mean, they invested heavily in infrastructure, as everybody knows, built train systems, big cities. I mean, Shanghai looks incredibly different than it did in the past. And now they're in the process of trying to shift from a development phase to a more consumption phase. And for an economy that size and one that's controlled the way it is, it's a big ask, right? So nobody really knows how that shift is going to happen. But you know, given that they are the way that they're controlled, they do have a plan. You know, they come out with 5-year plans, and they do execute, you know, reasonably well on these plans. And so, you know, some of the new plans that they have are this One Belt, One Road initiative, which is really partnering with other countries across Asia to develop more markets and more trade routes. And, you know, that's pretty ambitious. But there is a shift happening, and it could create volatility. And also what happened, they went from being the factory floor destination for companies, and that's happening a lot less now. Companies are leaving because of the trade talks and because of more expensive labor. And also a lot of the money in China has, you know, as they've gotten wealthier, has gone to other destinations. So China was a big factor in the world growth, you know, over the last 20 years. But a lot of that was commodity driven and building this infrastructure. Now they may become one of the biggest customers of the world. You know, it remains to be seen how long that's going to take. But companies have already been catering to the Chinese consumer. And I think they'll continue to do that. So whether or not you want to, you know, go directly into China, which has its own, you know, risks, versus investing in companies that, you know, that get access to China, I think that's probably the route that we'll take, you know, for the most part in the portfolios. But that being said, the other thing that's happening is that the Chinese consumer is developing, and a lot of the companies, you know, they have their own version of Silicon Valley. As we come out with one company, they come out with their own version of it. And those consumer-oriented technology companies are still growing at, you know, 30% rates. And the retail sales in China may be slowing. It went from 8% down to about 7%. That's still a healthy growth rate. So I think there's still things to watch in China, but they're definitely decelerating and changing, and it's something that we need to be cautious with, but also, you know, look for opportunities.
Yeah, their version of Amazon and their version of Facebook are as advanced or more advanced than what we have.
Right, and there's 750 million people on a cell phone in China or more, and here we have about 250 million, so important place.
And I'll just add that with volatility comes opportunities, so I think the bigger mistake would be just ignore China altogether because of the slowdown.
Well said.
Yeah, good. All right, let's switch gears and talk about oil. So the U.S. has made tremendous progress towards energy independence here in our country. Our oil production per rig is far more productive today than it was 10 years ago. And in fact, Texas this year, 2019, is on track to pump more oil than both Iraq and Iran. So that's pretty significant. Joe, could you comment on what trends you see developing here and what investment ideas you think could benefit from this energy shift?
Yes, there's geopolitical implications here in that we're not as beholden to the Middle East as we used to be. But the oil boom has come from technological advancements by a large number of companies that do this fracking, this horizontal drilling. And I've been thinking recently that there is probably a pretty direct connection between Federal Reserve policy and our energy independence. And the reason I make that statement is the New York Times reported that 80% of the fracking companies actually lose money. And they're staying in business because of low interest rates and easy access to credit. So in a strange way, our low interest rate policy has helped the energy boom. I don't know what that means when interest rates go up and companies are having trouble making their payments. Another thing I'd like to mention is if we could go beyond oil and just talk about energy in general. Breakthroughs in solar technology is making that source of energy more and more attractive. And as you all know, we recently added a solar manufacturing company to your portfolios. I think to answer the question in a broad sense, we're looking at energy in a much more open-minded approach. When it comes right down to petrochemicals, though, one of the most attractive areas, I think, in the oil and gas area is not necessarily drilling it, but it's moving it through our pipeline system. Master Limited Partnerships, which are stock-like investment vehicles, pay out almost 90% of their utility-like earnings in dividends, and there are yields north of 7%. So, there are opportunities, I think, in the more emerging solar sector, and also directly in moving oil and gas through the pipeline system.
Yeah, and I'll just add, Joe, that since the recession, and you could also call it the oil recession back in 2008, a lot of those MLP companies, the transportation pipeline companies, they got smart. They improved their balance sheets, and you don't see the type of leverage today that we had 10 years ago. So they can weather any ups and downs in oil prices over the next few years.
Good point. Another area that I think warrants discussing is the recent cuts that we've seen in global growth for this year. Pat, what would you suggest in terms of the slowdown? Where are we heading in terms of a global recession? Is that coming? Is that looking at us in the face?
I wish I knew that answer. But I think that we have seen growth decelerate around the world, and especially in Europe. I think Europe looks to be the closest to recession right now. China's decelerating, and they always tend to stimulate their economy as they decelerate. So that may be something that will likely be something they continue to do. So in the near term, I think that there is some risk of continued global slowdown, and we're monitoring those risks. But in the longer term, I think that the global economy is growing faster than the developed economy, and we want to be focused there. So it's just making sure that we don't expose ourselves in too much of the portfolio to areas that can be heaviest impacted to this global growth slowdown, which looks like world trade is slowing down, and that doesn't necessarily affect the global GDP growth that much, but it is something to watch. So there are sectors that are more impacted, like autos and some others, that we should just be cautious of. But it's also going to be interesting to see. We had 1 year where there was a synchronized global boom and another year where there was a synchronized global slowdown. That's not always the case. Mm-hmm. So there may be, with diversification, there may be years where having different countries, they may do well versus others. So,
Sean, what would you add to that?
Well, I think it's too early to call for a global recession. About 6 months ago, economists had pegged global GDP growth at about 3.5% for 2019. You fast forward to today, and the growth rate is now at 3.2%. So it's slowing, but still a decent growth rate. We think it's important to track how companies are investing, and we can do this by looking at their capital expenditures, or CapEx. Because historically, there has been a fairly tight correlation between GDP growth rates and CapEx. And right now, CapEx is in a funk. But the funk can be partially explained by the rising trade tensions between the U.S. and China, as companies have decided to defer big spending plans until they can gain more clarity on the tariff situation. So again, we think it's too early to call for a global recession, but we are watching company investing levels closely for signs of a recession.
It's also important to look at the market prices. I think there are some areas of the market that are signaling that they think there will be a recession, and if they're wrong, then those are opportunities to either sell or buy into. So I think it's important, too, to look at areas where the market may be overreacting and try to make decisions based on that, too.
Okay. Let's move to emerging markets, which continue to post much higher economic growth rates than developed countries like the U.S., the U.K., and also Germany. Joe, are you finding good investment opportunities in the emerging market space, or are the risks just too great?
The risks are mitigated by the fact that the stock prices are low. We have emerging markets in the portfolios. It's been helping our returns. The two big stories are obviously China and India. We are rather light on China. We have exposure to India. The Latin America and Russia, we have a terrific fund that has been profiting from some extraordinarily good buys in those areas. Look, let's face it, there are a billion people that are coming on to the middle class for the first time. They're going from bicycles to mopeds, from mopeds to used cars. We sent you figures on about India and how like one out of every 10 households has a washing machine. I mean, there's potential to sell hundreds of millions of washing machines. We already have a washing machine in every house in America. So that's where the growth is going to come from. And so we need to be there. Markets, yeah, they're volatile, but for the rest of our lives, chances are those economies are going to grow faster than the developed economies of the United States, Europe, and Japan.
But I think they need to continue to develop their markets, and they are. And there's a stat that showed that the emerging markets are only 11% of the market value of the world, but they're 40% of the economy. Mm-hmm. So over time, it's likely that you know, the market values in the markets will continue to expand. And there's been a lot more IPOs in those countries versus the U.S., and that's, you know, so if there's more businesses out there too, that's a good sign.
Well, that kind of segues into my next question, which is 2019 has been a year of some high-profile initial stock offerings or IPOs, as Pat just mentioned. Two notable names came to the marketplace this year, both Lyft and Uber, which I'm sure you're both familiar with. Two companies with a combined market valuation approaching $100 billion, but are losing billions of dollars each year. While the losses are unsettling, analysts expect both companies to double revenues over the next 3 years. So Pat, what would you say, you know, when you hear something like this, what comes to mind and why are investors attracted to names like this?
Well, I'm a fan of the service.
I think we all are, right? Who hasn't used it?
I've been scratching my head at how they can lose billions of dollars, but I think what happens with these companies is they keep investing aggressively for growth. I mean, that's growth of the revenue, and they just, you know, regardless of whether they lose money or spend more than they take in on an annual basis. And, you know, if they don't one day earn a profit, then that's a problem. You know, but investors, especially when the markets get frothier and technology has been such a good place to be for such a long time, that investors are getting maybe overconfident right now, where you're seeing the amount of IPOs that have no profitability in the, when they come out, go from
90%.
Yeah, over, you know, and that's almost all of them. And so why would someone do that? Well, either they think, you know, maybe the company will be bought out, or one day they'll hit profitability. But there are a lot of IPOs that, that you know, come out high and then fall. And we've been looking at reports, it's maybe 50-50 right now. But I think it's unlikely that if these companies can't become profitable that they're going to stay anywhere near these valuations.
You know, an IPO is when a company goes public for the first time. It means that it was owned by the insiders, privately, private investors, and then they're selling their stock to the public, putting it on the stock market. So the people selling it obviously want the highest price possible. And when you have a stock market cycle that has a lot of greed and aggressive behavior, which happens after prices have gone up a lot, that's a great time for the insiders to sell their stock to the public. And the old Forbes magazine used to have a great definition of what IPO stands for. They said instead of initial public offering, it should stand for it's probably overpriced.
It's a good one.
and it's not that every IPO is overpriced. We do look at them and we try to see if there's a good business here or there, because sometimes one slips through that is reasonable, but most of them tend to come out overpriced.
Any comments, Sean, that you want to add?
Yeah, I think the interest from individual investors comes from the success of Amazon, Facebook, Netflix, and the returns that investors earned by buying on that first offering. What's different now is that companies are coming public much later in their business cycle. So they've spent more years as a private business, and they've been able to do that because there's so much money from private equity investors to help fund these businesses over their initial years. So the good growth that an Amazon experienced in its first 5 or 10 years as a public company, you're not seeing that with these new companies. Those years are behind them. It's the private equity investors that really capitalized on those first 5 or 10 years of their business. So I think at some point in time, that's going to get out, or just it's going to be a known factor that the expected growth rates are going to be different for these what they call them unicorn companies, and then just the interest is just going to wane.
It's important, I think, to maintain a consistent investment strategy over time. Today's market actually seems to be rewarding companies or rewarding individuals with companies with weaker balance sheets, higher revenue growth rates, and in some cases, no earnings at all. I'll also include a quote here from Warren Buffett, which says, "What we learn from history is that people don't learn from history." So why don't we start off with you, Shanks? We haven't started off with you on a question. What business characteristics are important when you evaluate companies for investments today?
Sure. And these are attributes that we've looked at for decades at Barry. They haven't changed. We want to focus on companies that have solid balance sheets, that have predictable cash flows, that are going to be able to service any debt they have, to pay dividends to their shareholders, and to fund growth. And we think when times become uncertain, when we get some increased volatility, like what we're experiencing now with the with trade war discussions, we think those companies with those attributes are going to have a premium to others.
Good. Either of you like to comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, I like to also look at the underlying trends, whether it's mm-hmm. consumer trends or just general economic trends, and things like big data and healthcare and transportation, entertainment, technology. You know, these are all things where you know there's more investment and there tends to be more growth. And whereas you know other parts of the economy may be declining or kind of going away. So we do look at the underlying trends. In addition to what Sean mentioned, we look at you know pricing power of these companies. But you know to get a good price for a company, there has to be either something off with it, something hopefully temporary that you can find, or they're not growing as fast as other parts of the economy that everybody's paying you know crazy prices for. So you know we like to search in those zones for companies that are reasonably priced to inexpensive, and you know look for good underlying trends and ones that you know, have pricing power.
Yeah, I mean, common sense would say that a company, let's say that is, you pay $12 for a dollar of earnings, let's say it's growing at single digits. Common sense would say that's more attractive than a company you have to pay $30 for a dollar of earnings with a big promise for future growth. You know, if you're buying a future growth estimate, that's very speculative. I mean, that's a real gamble. But that's what's been popular. And that goes through cycles, too. I call it growth glamour versus good old hard value. And it's way overdue to shift and disappoint on, you know, the speculative buys. And we think it's going to bring the old traditional good math that goes behind value companies back in the forefront and back to outperformance.
And we also look at, you know, companies that are maybe smaller in size. We try to blend a mix of companies that are large and well-established that maybe pay a good dividend with ones that, you know, have been around maybe for 10 or 20 years, but, you know, have potential to grow from a smaller base of $2 billion maybe up to $20 billion. So it's trying to blend you know, those types of companies together.
Good. So let's close out and let's end on more of a short-term question about what we foresee for the portfolio this year. You know, obviously, in light of the volatility, you know, we want to, you know, stay invested. That's, you know, the sound thing to do. But in the short run, you know, anything come to mind in terms of opportunities or anything that you guys are looking at that you think warrant a closer look?
I'd just say that there has been sizable price swings in both the bond market and the stock market. I mean, we saw a 20% decline in the fall and then a big rally in the first quarter. With bonds, we saw rates go from about 3.4 down to 2.8 right now. So investors are shifting their expectations pretty wildly in their movements. So I do think that while we want to have core positions and good ideas that we want to have for the long run, I do think it is a more active environment, and you've seen some additional activity earlier this year, and if it continues to be like this, we'll likely continue to have more activity But with the mind of keeping a core portfolio in there and maybe moving 5 to 10% around the edges while we see these movements.
Yeah, we had the sharp sell-off in December, and we added some names, pretty recognizable brands. Recently, we trimmed a little bit on some of our longer-term holdings. So the market's going to dictate. It's all, you know, old Mr. Market. If Mr. Market gets in a very bad mood, gets in his, not his manic, but his depressive mood, we get opportunities to buy great companies at lower prices. We'll take advantage of it, like we did the end of last year.
And maybe move cash balances down. And, you know, right now we're seeing some strength in the bonds. If it continues, we might trim, you know, on the bond side. So we'll...
But I think one thing that volatility can do, although we, you know, nobody likes to go through it, it can also create great buying opportunities for the portfolio. So, Sean, on that, any final comments from you before we close out?
Yes. We're sticklers for valuation. You've heard us mention price multiple times here, and we're very sensitive to how these investments are priced. And we want to protect our downside risk, but we also want to participate in the upside. So we've been patient with our investments, and we believe that there are going to be continued opportunities over the next few months and quarters, and we plan to participate when we see the right time.
Well, let me say thank you for listening to the call, and once again, thank you for so many years of being our client. We really, really love being of service to you. So I will end with our appreciation. And also, as a reminder, all of our regulatory materials are available online, or give us a call at Barry Investment Advisors. Thank you.
Thanks.